An administrative note, next Sunday we put our clocks back, so time change next Sunday. Put our clocks back 1 hour. This week I was watching a little video cast at one of my favorite preaching websites, and this one minister was talking about three important things about preaching, and he said three things that should happen in the midst of a good sermon is that we're taught by the biblical story. Secondly, that we might be inspired, emotively moved. And thirdly, that we might be transformed, that we might be called to action or called to engagement, moved because our head, our hearts, and our hands have been inspired to be agents of transformation. So to get our minds thinking a bit about new understandings or transformation this morning, I want to share a bit about a book that came to my attention this week called Unlikely Disciple. And the subtitle is A Sinner's Semester at America's Holiest University. Unlikely Disciple, A Sinner's Semester at America's Holiest University. Has anyone read that book? Okay, this is a new one. It's actually written by someone who's been mentored by this A.J. Abrams, who I referred to about a month ago, who wrote The Year of Living Biblically. So I thought it was interesting to hear about this guy who's written a book called The Unlikely Disciple. And the author is Kevin Roos. He's an average Brown University student. Brown is a Ivy League university in Providence, Rhode Island. On a side note, it was founded by Baptists, Brown University, though they declare on their website, "We have long left our Baptist affiliation," FYI. So Kevin Roos is this average Brown University student who met some Liberty University students in his first year. And Liberty is Jerry Falwell's mega university, 11,000 students on campus, 40,000 students who in one way or another do online or part-time work with this university, founded in 1971 by the late Reverend Jerry Falwell. And so Kevin met some people from Liberty University and was intrigued. At first, he found it awkward because he just didn't know how to relate to these people that he felt were so different than him. And so he decided that he wanted to know more about evangelical culture. And secondly, he wanted to explore a bit of his own faith journey. He had a bit of a religious background, but thought it might be interesting to find out from these evangelicals more about God, Christian education, faith. And so in the middle of his sophomore year, he applied to Liberty University, and he got accepted. So second semester, sophomore year, he goes to Liberty. And so he goes undercover. He buys the book, The Bible for Dummies. He talks to this one Christian high school friend of his to help him say the right things. He even buys a book called How to Tame Your Tongue in 30 Days so that he wouldn't be cursing so much, because Liberty has a 46-page code of conduct. And so there's lots of do's and don'ts to that. And so he wanted to, you know, be a good undercover student. And the goal of this book, as he responds in interviews, he says, the goal of this book was to try to get an honest picture of the day-to-day life at America's biggest Christian university. And the goal of the book is also, for him, cultural reconciliation, bringing disparate groups together. And it's also a book about his spiritual journey. And so he talks about his spiritual encounter with God. He says, I came to Liberty University God ambivalent, had lots of questions, was wondering what this God thing was all about. I didn't expect to change. But then he says, I was surrounded by faith and surrounded by love. And it really rubbed off. It changed my views. He said, I felt my views were shifting. And now he would say that he's a Christian, though he's quick to add, not a Liberty born-again conservative Christian. So whatever that means. He says, I do pray. My prayer life was changed. I try to pray every day. And he says, I think my faith was shaped forever by my experience at Liberty. Whatever you think of Liberty University or the journalistic credibility of Kevin Roos, I thought it was interesting that Roos came to Liberty University with several preconceived ideas about Liberty students, about God, and he came away with this new understanding. He was literally transformed. And so even as we enter into this Job 42 and Mark chapter 10 text today, what about us? Are we open to gaining new understandings about God? As we look at Job 42, we need to do a bit of what I'm calling a 41-chapter Jobian jaunt, so that we have a bit better context here. If you haven't looked at the book of Job for a while, the book of Job is poetry. Anne Bellamy, who was teaching us about wisdom literature a few weeks ago in our Sunday morning pre-service 6 weeks of theological education class, said Job is wisdom literature. And so what you find in Job is this poetic dialogue, either between Job and his friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, or Job and God. And interposed in the midst of this is a brief interlude on what might be called the inaccessibility of wisdom, Job asking, where does wisdom come from? And then also the musings of another friend, a younger generation friend named Elihu. And the book's themes go along the lines of the suffering of the righteous, prosperity of the wicked. And one of the main theological questions of Job is, will mortals fear God apart from rewards and punishment? Will mortals fear God apart from rewards and punishment? So as we enter into Job 38 then, this is called the climax of Job, and it's this aha moment where God responds to all of Job's questions, and it's called the divine speech. God responds out of the whirlwind in Job 38 and for several chapters afterwards, a voice out of chaos, and he asks questions like, who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Or he asks, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Or he says, who determined its measurements? On what were its bases sunk? Or who shut in the sea with doors? So this is our Jobian jaunt. We've got all these things going on in Job. It's this poetic dialogue. There's lots of mystery. There's lots of beauty. There's lots of wrestling with God and who he is and who we are as humankind. And then we enter Job 42, the final chapter of Job, where we get a glimpse of what I'm calling Job's new understanding. Then Job answered the Lord in verse 42:2, I know that you can do all things, and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. And then he goes on to say in verse 5, I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eyes see you. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. I want us to hang on to that phrase in verse 5. I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eyes see you. This is echoed in our text from Mark 10 today, where Jesus says to blind Bartimaeus, what do you want me to do for you? And the blind man says to him, my teacher, let me see again. And Jesus said to him, go forth, your faith has made you well. Immediately he regained his sight and followed him on the way. I want to pause here and ask three questions. One is, what is God wanting us to see today? And even as Sandy Smith led us in our prayers of the people today, I think she prepared the way for us too. What is God wanting us to see today? Or maybe, to put it differently, you can put the question this way. Is there a journey of new understanding happening in our lives today? Is there a journey of new understanding happening in our lives today? Or maybe a third way of putting it, can you think of something or some situation that God is moving you through, or maybe us through as a community of faith, where we can say, in a kind of paraphrasing way with Job, I had heard, God, that you were blank, but now I see that you are blank. I'd heard that you were blank, but now I see that you are blank. I want us to take time for that. And we won't have lots of time in this morning's service, but take some time to listen to what the Spirit is saying to us as a community of faith, to us as believers in God, to us who are calling ourselves followers of Jesus. I think some of us are so busy that we don't want God to change. Because if God changes, I've got enough things that are changing in my life that's going to really mess around with my world. So don't teach or preach about a God who transforms or changes, because I'm really too busy to handle that. I just want God here so that I can get on with my life. Or maybe to answer that question this week, you need to put yourself in the place of blind Bartimaeus. What was he seeing even in the midst of his blindness? When Jesus asks us, "What do you want me to do for you?" What really is the answer of our heart? When Jesus says, "What do you want me to do for you?" What's the answer of our heart? I'm pretty sure I know what the answer of my brain is. Let me have a long, healthy life, pain-free. Or let me have more money, if I only had more money. Or maybe for us ministers, it's often along the lines of, I want a big church, I want a successful reputation, I want to go down in the history books as having these glory years. Some people call it the ABCs of church success: attendance, building, and cash. If I could only get the ABCs, I'd be one happy minister. But what are the deep answers of our hearts? If we, like blind Bartimaeus, were looking towards Jesus and he said to us, "What do you want me to do for you?" Would we really say, "Jesus, give me cash. Need cash, Lord. Need cash." I'd like to propose that we would answer differently. And I'd like to hope that our answer would come out of a place of weakness versus a place of strength. And I don't know if we even know how to get to those places of weakness in our busy, consumeristic, priority-filled lives. But Bartimaeus knew his weakness. Several weeks ago, a few of us on staff learned from a spiritual director an exercise for helping us to go to deeper places where we share about ourselves. And it seemed like this simple three-phrase challenge, but when done and put into practice in the midst of people that you trust, it's really challenging. It's three phrases, and the first phrase is "see my," and then you fill in the blank with a strength of yours. So that's the first phrase. The second phrase is "see my," and then you fill in the blank with a weakness of yours. And then the third phrase is "see me." And so in the group of, you know, two or three or four trusted friends, though this exercise seems simple, it really moves you to a place of vulnerability and depth. See my strength. See my weakness. See me. And I was thinking about blind Bartimaeus. If he did that exercise, I think he'd say, "See my stubborn perseverance to get heard. See my loss, my exclusion, my helplessness. See me." What might you say if you were sharing that exercise? And, you know, I would strongly encourage you as a spiritual practice to try that. Try that with someone you trust. And help it move you to these places of weakness, because we're so often prone to just operate from places of strength. If you want to know my three, I'll tell you, but I'm not going to tell you here. I want to come back to my first question of a few minutes ago. What's God wanting us to see today? I'm going to come back to this, but I do want to talk about Job's puzzling payoff before I do. Job's puzzling payoff. If you're not a priority type Christian, a prosperity gospel type of Christian, then reading through the lectionary text for this week are really a challenge. Because Bartimaeus gets healed, God pronounces his verdict in favor of Job versus Job's friends. God vindicates Job with a double portion of everything. And in Psalm 34, if you read our Psalm 34 of the week, there's phrases like, "The one who blesses the Lord is saved from every trouble and is rescued from all her afflictions." So how do we hold on to this great payoff kind of God in the midst of a world so full of pain and suffering? And this might feel good to know that we're going to be prosperous and get blessed, but we know that even in the midst of the sanctuary today, many of us carry sorrow, many of us carry sadness, many of us carry loss. We don't have lots of happily ever afters in our lives. Job got to see four generations of his family, and you and I might know parents of children who didn't even get to see their 10th birthday. So how do we make sense of this puzzling payoff? I believe the answer is in the whole story of God. And here's why we're not going to be that proof-texting kind of church where we pick and choose bits and snippets of the Bible and then find a position on something and then prop up our argument. That's why we're not going to be a culture war fighting type of church. We're not going to fumble around with all the hot social issues that are out there and then find reasons to fight for or against a certain issue. We're going to be a community of faith that puts ourselves under the whole story of God. And I've been talking about this over the past few weeks. So as we wrestle with Job's double blessing, we're going to step back and look at the whole story of God. And thus we won't say, "See, Job did the right thing and he got a double blessing." Instead, we'll say, "Yes, Job got blessed in the end, but this is the same Job who had his whole family and all his possessions taken in chapter 1. And he became full of boils and sores in chapter 2. And yet he said, 'The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord.' This is the Job who said, 'Shall we accept good from God and not trouble?'" And so as we put ourselves under the whole story of God and we read a psalm like Psalm 34 with, again, blessings for the people of God, we'll take a step back and look at the whole counsel of God, and we'll look at psalms like Psalm 22, where we read, my God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And we'll remember that maybe last week we were in that place, or maybe next week we'll be in that place. So maybe it is okay to embrace some of that blessing this week in Psalm 34. Or when we read of Jesus' healing, we won't say, "See, Jesus healed people, they got better. You just need to have more faith." Instead, we'll read all the Gospels. Anne was teaching us about the Gospels today, this morning. We'll read all the Gospels and we'll read stories of great healing, but we'll also read stories where Jesus was pressed in by the crowd and people wanted a piece of him. And what did he do? He ran away. He went to that quiet place. He didn't heal everyone all the time. So the payoff is not in the payoff. The payoff, and that's not a great word, but the payoff is in the presence, not the presence. Play on words. The presence of God, not these gifts or double portions of possessions and blessings. And so as we close, as we try to answer the question today, God, what are you wanting us to see? I want us to close it with, hopefully, prayers and phrases like this. God, help us to get it through our minds and hearts that you're not a God who wants to serve our desires to get it right, prove a point, or win an argument. Help us today to reaffirm our commitment to your presence. May that truly be the payoff for us. Not that we're healed of our infirmities right away, but that we are known and loved as your precious children. and that that may be the fragrance of our testimony in the city. That the payoff is not that we're going to tell others of how to have a better life, but the gift that we have is this presence of God through the person of Christ and the power of the Holy Spirit. A majestic God who invites us all to be a people grounded in grace and rooted in love. So for a moment, I want to give us a quiet moment to pray. And this phrase, grounded in grace and rooted in love, has really hung with me all week. So I hope that might just be the foundation for your prayer or your listening to God, even in 1 minute of silence today. That we're grounded in grace, we're rooted in love. What is God, in the midst of that, wanting us to see today? What is that new understanding that God's revealing to us as we're grounded in grace, as we're rooted in love? And maybe your quiet prayer will be a prayer of gratitude, echoing Job, "But now my eyes see you." Or maybe your prayer will echo blind Bartimaeus, where you'll say, "Jesus, Son of David, Rabboni, let me see again." So in a quiet moment, we're grounded in grace and rooted in love. Let's quietly listen to God. We hear the word of the psalmist, "Come, O children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord. Which of you desires life and covets many days to enjoy good? Keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking deceit. Depart from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. The eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are open to their cry. The face of the Lord is against evildoers to cut off the remembrance of them from the earth. When the righteous cry for help, the Lord hears and rescues them from all their troubles. The Lord is near to the brokenhearted and saves the crushed in spirit. Lord, in your mercy, hear our prayers. Amen."